Hello and welcome to the World Soccer Talk podcast, your weekly dose of talking about watching soccer on TV, online and apps. Coming up on episode 57, we discuss the impact Landon Donovan could have on Liga MX TV ratings. And now that he's coming out of retirement, how much of an impact is that going to have? As well as our opinions about the implementation of VAR in the FA Cup and whether the technology is sucking the atmosphere out of games. Plus, we have letters from you, the listeners, in our mailbag section. My name is Christopher Harris, a.k.a. The Gaffer, and I'm joined today by Kartik Krishnaya. Kartik, how are you feeling? Any better than last week with the cold?
I'm still a little bit under the weather, but thanks for asking.
Okay, well, it's that time of the year. I think everyone's getting sick, so hang in there, Kartik, and the same to the listeners, too. Even though the weather down here is beautiful, as opposed to some of the snow up north, but... All right. So, Kartik, what you've been watching this past week? Let's talk about that first.
Yeah, I've had a bit of a mixed week. We had a number of games in town that I was working, so didn't get to watch as much football as I would like. I started off with the Leverkusen Bayern game on Friday, which was Stu Holden and Keith Costigan, and a pretty good game. Leverkusen, first game coming off of a winter break, and Leverkusen looked good for long portions of the match, but Bayern won after just this brilliant shot from Hannes Rodriguez. Costigan and Holden were very good. I think we talked about this before on the show. Keith Costigan really coming into his own as both a commentator and a reporter.
Yeah, for this one, it was interesting too, Kartik. I'm not sure if you caught this, but right when they had the graphics coming up for this game, usually like 2 minutes before the game, it said, Bayer Leverkusen against FC Bayern Munich. And underneath it, it said the Bundesliga, football as it's meant to be. And I understand where they're coming from with this in terms of ownership and grassroots and a lot of German youth internationals or German youth playing in this league, great crowds, etc. I posted a picture of this to Twitter, to the World Soccer Talk account. And one of the followers, I can't remember who it was, but said, yeah, football as it's meant to be. Bayern Munich is kind of 13 points ahead in the Bundesliga. Now, this can apply to a lot of leagues this season, not just the Bundesliga. You got the Premier League and La Liga, where the top teams are just running away with it. But I just thought it was interesting in terms of the Bundesliga, kind of a bit of a stab or poke at some of these other leagues. But football as it's meant to be.
Well, I think as we have these conversations in the United States about creating a new structure, a more effective structure, the general sense is if you're going to keep some degree of organic feel, the German structure is much better than the English or Spanish structure in terms of ownership and what's permitted. Look, I have strong opinions about the Premier League and about what might happen down the road with the Premier League as clubs continuously are getting flipped and foreign owners are coming in and really kind of trying to cash in on television money. Right now, it all looks rosy, but the thing we do know is that the Bundesliga will never have some sort of artificial bubble where it cracks. We're not sure about other leagues. So I can kind of relate to that sentiment, to be perfectly honest with you. No, I don't like the lack of competition at the top. And RB Leipzig has shown what happens if you follow a different kind of ownership structure, how quickly you can climb the leagues and then climb the first division table in that country. But there are some, certainly as we evaluate our fandom as football supporters and our values and our ethos and those sorts of words, you realize the Bundesliga has something to offer that the other leagues in Europe tend to lack these days.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, to me, it's football. Football as it's close meant to be. Meant to be close. It's not exactly it, but it's pretty close to it. At that same time, Kartik, you and I are also watching the Sheffield United, Sheffield Wednesday, Steel City derby separately. You were watching it from home, so was I. But what are your thoughts on that one?
Yeah, I thought that Sheffield Wednesday is having a terrible season, and they have been so close to getting promoted the last two seasons, really have been unlucky they haven't gone up. You got Sheffield United back in the championship, flying, and they reached the Steel City Derby. Sheffield Wednesday's reduced to 10 men, and they hang on for a 0-0 draw. I enjoyed the telecast. I'm now getting very used to John Kent champion on Fridays. Mm-hmm. So that's something that's becoming part of my Friday diet, along with trying to watch some Bundesliga, is watch John Champion. Again, it may not be working this way for everybody, but the championship is so accessible this season on ESPN3. Unfortunately, this might be the only season we enjoy it this way because of the new Disney pay service that's going to launch in the near future. But as long as we have the access to the league we have now, I'm really enjoying it.
Yeah, and for those listeners who are interested and do want to check it out, this Friday, I believe, is Bristol City against Derby County. So two teams in that pack of the top four, top five, they are going for it. And yeah, to me, the actual Sheffield Derby, this one wasn't as entertaining as the first one earlier this season, but still captivated me, still pulled me in. And to me, it was Sheffield Wednesday were actually, I think, more happier about getting the points at the end of the day. But anyway, it wasn't the greatest game, but I did enjoy it. And of course, John Champion, it seems that anything he's on these days is quality. So what else, Kartik? What else do you watch this past weekend?
Well, no, Real Madrid-Villarreal was really interesting. Look, Madrid, some people might think they're getting unlucky. I just don't think they're very good at this point. Without Cristiano carrying them, they have a lot of things that are bringing them back to the pack in La Liga. We've seen it the last 2 weeks since the La Liga winter break ended. They were very fortunate to get a draw two weekends ago. And then this past weekend at the Bernabeu against Villarreal, I thought they were the better team for much of the game, but not so substantially better that the result was an injustice. And they got beat 1-0. By Villarreal. They're now 19 points behind Barca. They do have a game in hand. They are 10 points behind Atleti. Again, they have a game in hand on Atleti. 10 points behind Atleti for second. So unless they beat PSG in the Champions League, which I have to say, look, we can talk about history, and we often use history to make determinations about these teams in Europe. I think this might be the one tie you completely disregard history, even recent history, which is PSG blowing a big four-goal lead against Barcelona in the last season and Real Madrid winning the last two Champions Leagues. I just don't see how this particular team and this form can even compete with PSG, let alone think about winning that tie. So I think it could be pretty one-sided and a humiliating end to the Real Madrid era, you know, losing on aggregate something like 7-2 or 5-1. I can see that happening. So it was interesting. And then Saturday after that, I had to work as the press officer for the Florida Cup match between Legia Warsaw and Barcelona of Ecuador. So missed the rest of the action. Kept an eye on the Everton Spurs match via text messages with some of my friends who are Everton fans. And I had DVR'd the game, but I quite frankly had no interest in watching the match after getting these text messages and realizing how bad Everton was.
Mm-hmm. What about the Warsaw, Legia Warsaw? What was the fan base like in terms of the support that they got for this game, which was in Fort Lauderdale?
Yeah, it was pretty remarkable. Now, the attendance for the game was terrible. The reported attendance was somewhere around 2,500, but a good 750 of those fans were Polish Legia Warsaw fans. A lot of Legia fans, and then a lot of people showing up with Polish national team shirts, Lewandowski shirts, a couple people with Bayern Lewandowski shirts. It was surprising because I thought bringing a Polish team here was a big risk. As it turns out, The problem was bringing Barcelona, who had come last year and had sold out the place, right? But you bring the same team two successive years. A lot of their supporters have traveled or have spent money on tickets to see him once in the last 12 months. They're not going to do it for a second time. The other thing I thought was really significant from my personal experience, Chris, and this is not meant to be ethnocentric or shots at anyone, so I hope people don't take this the wrong way. The professionalism of Legia Warsaw, the professionalism that I've experienced when you and I have dealt with European clubs before, as opposed to clubs in other parts of the world, was pretty tremendous. Legia is not necessarily staffed like a Premier League or Bundesliga team, but they were staffed enough. They were staffed like, let's say, an MLS team, and they were extremely professional. And the media that had come from Poland to cover the match, and there were a number of them. I think I had credentialed about 8 to 10 journalists from Poland, journalists and between writers and photographers, right? Photojournalists and writers, extremely professional, a lot less fussy than the average American or Latin American reporter, a lot less needy, very, I think, happy to be here, excited that they were covering a Polish club in a competition like this with clubs of great prestige. So it was a great experience dealing with them. And then Barcelona, I had dealt with last season in a similar role. Barcelona of Ecuador, they brought less media this time, but it was an interesting experience. I've never been exposed to Polish football before. So it was neat.
Up close, right. Yeah, I did catch, so I missed that game, but I did catch Sunday's game on Fox Deportes, which was the River Plate against Santa Fe, I think from Colombia, friendly.
Yeah.
And that was, I mean, to watch it as a TV, I mean, the pitch looked great. That's the field that the Fort Lauderdale Strikers used to play on after they left Lockhart Stadium. But it seemed quite a lot of River Plate fans there. Of course, South Florida, I mean, is a kind of a huge Argentine communities, especially in Miami. But the crowd was good. The level of football was decent. And actually on television, it looked great. But I think it was an entertaining match from what I saw.
Yeah, Santa Fe, I thought, was the better of the two teams. And I've now seen Santa Fe 3 times in the last 2 years. Saw them in Orlando in Florida Cup, saw them here in Boca Raton in Florida Cup, and now I've seen them in Fort Lauderdale in this friendly. 3 times in person, I'm saying. And they have really impressed me with their style of football each time. So that's a club, I think, as I try and dig deeper into South American football, that I'm going to follow more closely. Because, again, sometimes you see a team in one match and you're really impressed. Like, I was impressed with how Legia played, even though they lost to Barcelona on Saturday. But now I've seen Independiente Santa Fe 3 times. Some against Bayer Leverkusen, actually, in one of those matches where they were really good in Orlando a few years ago. I quite like them, to be honest with you. And I don't know much about the history of the club, but the football they play is really appealing. River Plate was fine too, but I was really kind of taken in again by Santa Fe.
So on Saturday, one of my kids had a tournament in the State Cup in Florida. So I was pretty much gone most of the day, so didn't get a chance to watch much football. I did watch the Swansea-Newcastle game. I watched, I think the first half on NBC Sports Gold. And then came back later in the day, probably like 6 o'clock at night, and watched the second half and just tried to do a stay away from all forms of communication throughout the day. So I didn't get the results spoiled. And actually, it was an entertaining game. Swansea under Carlos Carvajal. I think they're still going down, but at least they're putting up a fight. They played 2 up front, which is the first time they've done that in a long, long time this season. And they're playing, they're fighting for it. They're trying harder. They're not as horrible to watch. It's a little bit more entertainment in there. So a lot of it will come down to the transfer window. But Newcastle also put up a good fight too. And 2 clubs in completely different positions in terms of all the turmoil that's happening off the pitch with the buyout or lack of a buyout at Newcastle. And then Swansea just trying to figure out a way to stay up this season and then rebuild. Now, Sunday's game, Kartik, we got to talk about this one. The Liverpool-Manchester City game. How would you rank this one in terms of entertainment? I mean, is this one of the best Premier League games of all time? Is it up there?
No, the Newcastle-Liverpool game. Look, there's defensive errors that created... I mean, there's... Again, we go through this on the show every week. We have to separate entertainment value from quality. I don't think it was really a quality football match. There were some quality goals on display. I mean, particularly, I think the Mane goal and the Firmino goal. But let's call it what it was. It was a team, Manchester City, with that hasn't been. No one goes at them, right? And when a team finally went at them, they got beat and made defensive errors, and quite frankly, doesn't have a whole lot of depth. We saw that. They didn't have a single striker to bring off the bench. And in Liverpool's case, they rise to the occasion at Anfield in these sorts of big shows. We know that. And they've done that historically, even when they haven't been competing for honors. Yet, and we'll see. They play at Swansea this week. I wouldn't be surprised if they drop points.
Kartik, we're so off on this one. I mean, I thought it was one of the best games I've seen in a long, long time. And yes, there were defensive mistakes that led to the goals, but that's going to happen when you've got two teams playing at full speed in terms of the passing, the movements, the pressing. This was football at its highest level. Over the entire 90 minutes, it was nonstop from beginning to end. And to me, this is a great example of a game to show to your kids or to younger people that might be interested in the sport, just showing them kind of how much of a difference this level is compared to other leagues. I mean, in terms of just the players on the pitch, it was absolutely sensational. And that's the thing, though, too, playing at these types of level, high speed, high pace, mistakes are going to happen. And Liverpool capitalized on those, definitely. But I enjoyed it. What I was particularly interested in, too, Kartik, especially for this show, is the post-match. And NBC Sports, yet again, with a pitch-side desk. And actually, somebody on Twitter, I think a few weeks ago, responding to this podcast, criticized us for praising NBC Sports and for having the pitch-side studio. I can't even remember which game it was. I think it was the Everton game, maybe. Praising them for that. And they said, like, well, if NBC Sports has paid almost $1 billion, of course they're going to get a pitch-side studio. But you mean Fox Sports has paid, you mean hundreds of millions of dollars, but we don't see any pitch-side studios from them. But in terms of NBC Sports, what they did with this, I think, was fantastic once again. And getting Jurgen Klopp to really open up, and it wasn't one of those canned media-trained interviews. I mean, he was really kind of talking from his heart.
It was fantastic. I mean, I don't know about the censors at NBC, if they're going to be more aware, or they're going to have a problem with Klopp coming on in the future. But that was just fantastic. He looks down at his microphone, sees it's NBC. I think he just was told, hey, you're doing an interview in English language. Looks down at NBC, says, oh, my boss will be watching. And John W. Henry. Yeah. And then throws out the expletive. Klopp is so engaging. Look, I got a lot of criticism on Twitter as I'm at this this game that we talked about, the Independiente game, tweeting about an hour after I'd watched this interview and went down to the ground, that there's just something different about Klopp and Mourinho. And you got these slew of Mourinho defenders who always come out after me when I say something about him. But not only did he get after Manchester City in a way Mourinho is scared to do even at home, right? In a way, Mourinho is scared to go after Klopp. He's scared to go after Wenger. Yeah, he has a great record against Wenger, but that's from parking the bus and, you know, having his players wind up Arsenal players. We saw it with Gabriel and David Costa a few seasons ago. And then the pure joy Klopp exudes when he has an interview like he had with Arlo White and Lee Dixon and Graham Lasso. You get Jose out, it's bitterness, it's anger, it's spite. I mean, he's the anti-Jose. I love him. I'm not a Liverpool supporter, but he's so good for the Premier League. I think he's so good for football. I know there are English journalists who would disagree with me, but I've had this conversation with so many people. I think Jose Mourinho is at the point where he is bad for the Premier League. I think in spite of all of this entertainment value, we're talking about how great the Premier League is as a spectacle. There is... the Mourinho factor makes it less enjoyable for so many of us. So Klopp, hats off to Jurgen Klopp.
I think in a way, though, too, the Premier League needs a villain. And this whole soap opera with him and Antonio Conte, as far as kind of the back and forth feud, is building up. It's building up to a crescendo, and at some point it's going to burst. And it's probably going to be bursting on the sidelines with them pushing each other back and forth. You know what I mean? So it's drama. It adds a different element. Yes, it's kind of we've been through this so many times with him, it gets a bit old after a while, but that's who he is.
Rafa, Arsene Wenger, Pep when he went to Spain, Claudio Ranieri, actually both in England and in Italy, now Antonio Conte. I mean, at some point, you have to stop defending the guy. Okay, I'm sorry, I'm taking a point of personal privilege here. So many people come after me about my Mourinho analysis, and I'm not analyzing him necessarily as a football manager, although I think he is not at the level he was a decade ago. I am talking about all these extracurricular things. And when you see Jurgen Klopp in an interview like that and the way his team approached the match, the same fixture Man United had a month ago and approached completely differently, you just positivity, I think, wins out over negativity for a lot of us. And Klopp wins out over Mourinho, and he's good for English football. He's good for global football. I think Jose, he had a time and a place, and he's accomplished a lot. I don't think anyone else could lead Porto or Inter maybe to winning the Champions League titles that they have, but I think his shelf life has expired.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think this match I saw up until about the 80th minute, and then I had to leave, which I was like, I didn't want to leave, but I had to go because I had to take my daughter to the next day of State Cup games. And so for the last 10 minutes, I listened to the audio commentary on the radio, BBC World Service through the UK, and I listened to it on TuneIn on the app in my car. And so my wife and I and my daughter was listening to this. And the last 10 minutes of this radio commentary was, I mean, I don't get to listen to radio commentaries that often, but this was extraordinarily good. It was Alan Green with commentating, Robbie Savage. And Robbie Savage, I don't like. At this point, he was just like shouting. But the last 10 minutes was just incredible. And listening to the crowd, hearing the goal that almost went in, I guess the hit the side netting, and just a really fantastic, inspirational experience. And it was one of those things that my daughter was listening to and going like, wow, that's great. I'd love to go to a game like that. And that's something that I think radio captures better than television in many ways. I mean, you just listen in and you kind of imagine things versus watching on television. And television's great too, but sometimes radio is even better. But Kartik, I did miss post-match. So post-match, I saw the Klopp interview later that day, I think on the NBC Sports website. Did anyone from City come out? I mean, did Pep come out?
Yeah. But Gundogan came out and was really good and analytical about the game. And Gundogan, of course, spent some time in the studio last year for NBC Sports. So very analytical, talked about the way Pep wants them to play, talked about why they weren't able to execute their game plan in this match. Some of the defensive errors, I think uncharacteristic errors from a player like Ederson, who's been so phenomenal this season. It was a really good, good analytical piece he gave. And then Ox came out from Liverpool. So they had three interviews. It was Ox. It was an Ox, ironically, on a day Arsenal lost, right, at Bournemouth. Ox, and that irony wasn't lost on Robbie Mustovac and the studio in Connecticut, though obviously Musto seems to have a thing with Arsenal, right? At least Arsenal fans would allege that, but Musto has proven correct on all of these and analysis of Wenger's teams. But they had Ox, they then had Gundogan come out, and then they had Klopp come out, and then they had a live match of the day, which I missed because I went to the the River Plate game, but I DVR'd it, and that was good because they were able to expand on the points that they made in goal zone in this live match of the day from that game, and then particularly from the Bournemouth Arsenal game. They're doing a live match of the day two again this week at 2 o'clock Eastern time, following goal zone, and whatever the Sunday, I'm blanking out on what the Sunday 11 a.m. game. I think it's the Southampton game, but that's an interesting concept, Chris. We've seen it occasionally in the 5 years NBC has had the Premier League rights, that when they do have allotted time, they can do match of the day live, which gives you extended highlight cuts. It's airing then around the same time it's airing in the UK as well. Extended highlight cuts and some really good analysis. What has ended up happening when they don't have that block of programming, when they have something they have to go off to right away, whether it's college football or it's college football on NBC, or if it's on NBCSN, it's something like rugby or cycling or college basketball, they then bury match of the day and match of the day two in the early morning hours of the next morning, and it just ends up being extended highlight cuts, which really is no different than the Premier League productions review show. So I think, and we've talked about this, I think on this show over and over again, right? They haven't found the right role for match of the day. If they can get that programming time more consistent right after the conclusion of games on Saturday, it's really difficult, but Sunday in particular, match of the day two, it can be a really useful show. And I think it was good. And let me, sorry, I'm jumping ahead to Monday, but I have to say the Premier League Goal Zone show with Liam McHugh and Robbie Musto on Monday was unusually good. Maybe it was because they only had one studio guy, but they got really deep into some serious issues regarding both Stoke and Manchester United and Alexis Sanchez and some of the other things going on around the league. So NBC, it's at times it's been stale. We've criticized them for that on this program. I think they've really raised their game again in the last month. I'm really enjoying watching the studio programs to the point where, Chris, I'll be honest with you, I'm back to where I was 3-4 years ago, where the games are great. The Premier League games, some of them are very entertaining, some of them are terrible, but I want to watch every studio program, whether it's the Premier League Live, the Match of the Day, the Goal Zone. And I think I had lost that, and perhaps you had lost that for quite some time.
Yeah, I like that they're flexible. So they have been doing different things, and I think they're trying to break out of that stale mode. And I think that we've seen that in the last couple of months. So that's positive. To me, though, Kartik, I just imagine, imagine if they had the World Cup rights. You mean what they would be planning for this summer in terms of their coverage and how they'd be looking at things, doing it differently, not copying ESPN, or just really kind of in terms of their analysis and also their network of talent. I mean, in terms of tapping into a lot of the experts in the UK and in the US, I think it really would have taken it to a whole new level. With Fox, we'll talk about that in a little bit, but we'll just have to wait and see and hope for the best with them. But now, in terms of other coverage, Kartik, did you get a chance to watch any of the FA Cup games? I know it's been a busy week for you.
No, I haven't.
All right, well, let me talk about that then. So I'll talk about the game on Tuesday, which is the Leicester-Fleetwood Town game. And that was Kevin Keatings and Clive Allen on the commentary. So from Fox's production point of view, they really mailed it in. It was just no studio coverage at all. And they just had one of the guys in-house doing some voiceover work in terms of this game. But with this one, for anyone who missed it, or even if you didn't miss it, if you saw it, there were 3 VAR incidents in this one game. And there were, I guess the challenging thing, and we talked about this in the last week's podcast too, is that it's still not smooth. It's still not seamless, that the way that VAR is implemented in the FA Cup games and the League Cup games that we've seen. A lot of that is the really kind of the relationship between the referee and the crowds and the television. So when an incident happens, and this happened quite a few times in this game, we don't know. We see the referee talking into his headset. We don't know if he's talking to his assistant referees on the pitch or a fourth official, or if they're talking to the crew manning the VAR and looking at all the cameras. So now the big incident in this one, Kartik, was that there was a disallowed goal. So Leicester, the last goal of this game, it was disallowed due to offside. It was a quick decision. Up went the flag, and then the referee went to his headset. Again, we're thinking that he's going to the VAR, but we're not sure. In this case, it was, I wouldn't say pretty obvious, but it was, yeah, I think we can say that, yes, he's going to the VAR on this one. Now, the challenge is from the point of the goal going in the back of the net, and then until the decision was made and then the kickoff began, the delay of the game was 1 minute and 44 seconds. So almost 2 minutes. The VAR was used, and the VAR ruled that it was onside, and they overturned for the very first time the assistant referee's flag and said, okay, it's a goal. So the two things on this is, one is the delay of the game, which you could argue that, you mean, it's 1 minute and 44 seconds. Ultimately, the correct decision was made. So the delay of the game, maybe that's okay, just because, I mean, it eventually made a correct decision. But the biggest thing, really, Kartik, and I posted this on Twitter on the World Soccer Talk account, is what does this do to the enjoyment of watching a soccer game? Because the TV viewers watching this game, and for a minute and a half, we're sitting there thinking, is it a goal or not a goal? And we're just sitting there. So it kills the atmosphere in the stadium. They don't know whether to celebrate a goal or whether to wait or to applaud. And for the TV viewer, they're sitting there watching the replays over and over again. And within about 10 or 15 seconds, we see, as a TV viewer, that it should have been a goal. But we're still waiting for the VAR to go through probably all the different angles and then ultimately for the referee to make his decision. Now, the other thing with this, too, is that there's still confusion because, yes, it looks like they're going to VAR, but there's no communication between the VAR and the referees and the commentators. So the commentators see the referee blow his whistle and point, and they think that he's running over to the camera or to the TV screen on the side of the pitch to take a closer look at this this incident, when in fact he blew his whistle and ran back to the center circle to go ahead and award the actual goal and get ready for the kickoff. So all, I guess all of us were confused. Probably some of the people in the stadium were confused. The TV viewers were confused. And then just the indecision from the referees to make the final decision. So to me, personally, I want to see this speeded up because 1 minute and 44 seconds is too long. They need to figure out a way to speed this up, but doing so in such a way that it doesn't speed it up so much that they make a wrong decision. But there has to be some type of communication, whether it's on the actual TV screens, the big monitors in the stadium that shows a VAR thing, or same thing for us too, where we see that it's going to a VAR, so we know that it's going to that rather than headset to a fourth official. So it's interesting, Kartik. What do you think? I mean, would you rather see a correct decision made, or would you rather have the atmosphere in the stadium, with the crowds cheering a goal, and the game continues on? Any thoughts on that?
I don't know, honestly. I think it's 50-50. It's well, six of one, half dozen of another. But part of it is you want calls to be correct and you want just results. But there is something mythical about matches that are decided because of dodgy calls, right? England, Argentina, the famous Leeds Bayern Munich European Cup final in 1975. There is always something dodgy. I mean, even the Premier League title in 2010, which I still maintain to this day, Manchester United should have won because there were dodgy calls in both matches between Manchester United and Chelsea that season that are often forgotten because Carlo Ancelotti's side broke the Premier League record for number of goals scored that season. But there's always a talking point that comes out of calls that cost clubs. Sheffield United got relegated in 2007 because of some dodgy calls in matches late in the season that that ended up that the club went down to League Two. Now maybe or League One, excuse me. Now they may be back into the Premier League the way they're playing this season. But 10 years later, a decade later, so more than a decade later, there's something we hang on to about poor officiating, bad calls, complaining about these calls for years to come that we will lose with VAR. At the same time, we'll have just results, and maybe we have to adjust our expectations as viewers and spectators of the sport that they're going to get the calls right. Now, what is frustrating, though, with VAR is when they don't get a call right. I will go back to that Arsenal-Chelsea first leg a week ago of the League Cup, first leg of the League Cup semifinal, where, to me, Maitland-Niles is clearly taken down by Victor Moses. I don't think you can argue it's not a penalty if you see that clearly. The official who was it Stuart Atwell? I'm trying to remember who it was now. Was it Martin Atkinson, I think it was, opted, I'm not sure, actually, opted not to even look at the replay. Now, was there someone in his ear watching the VAR saying, this is nothing, and the referee then deferred to that person and didn't make the decision himself, which he should be doing, or they just blew it? I don't know. Mm-hmm. That's what frustrates me. So if you're going to have these delays, you're going to have these stoppages, you're going to change our expectations for viewing the game and for spectators when we attend matches, then you better get the calls right. If you have those and you don't get the calls right, like that one, in my opinion, and Arsenal would go back to the Emirates. Well, who knows how the match would have played out if they had scored a goal at that point. But in any event, it might affect the final who lifts the cup at the end of the League Cup. And I'll admit, I have a historic grievance because of a call that was made against Manchester City in that same League Cup semifinal, actually the second leg at Anfield in 2012, a handball on Micah Richards that never should have been called, and Liverpool lifted the cup and City was eliminated in that round. And I still hang on to that as if we had had VAR, that call would have been corrected. Well, maybe it wouldn't have been in hindsight. Maybe Liverpool still wins. Gets a penalty, wins the second leg, or gets the goals they need in the second leg, and then beats Cardiff in penalties a month later. So yeah, that's my problem. If you're not going to get the calls right, Chris, then don't bother.
It's an interesting topic, though, too, Kartik, because even with VAR, not 100% of the calls are going to be still correct. So there's going to be mistakes done by the people doing the VAR. One other comment, too. This is from Andy Woodard, and this is through Twitter. He says, I'm all about no video replay in any sport. Let games played by humans be officiated by humans. Everyone makes mistakes. The majority of officials are spot on. Just play the game, in my opinion, replays will kill the beautiful game. Just say no to replay. And there was a lot of comments, too, similar to that, too, where they just said that this is going to change the way that we view and watch soccer. The other thing, Kartik, which is really interesting, is that Martin Tyler, in an interview last week, said that if VAR had been in place several years ago, and for the Manchester City QPR game where City won the title on that incredible game, he said that in the back of his mind, knowing that there could be some indecision about the actual whether it was a legitimate goal or not, could have affected his commentary. So, you mean the famous commentary with the Aguero? You mean the call that he did might have changed if VAR was in place? And it does make you wonder too, because there will be indecision anytime now the ball goes into the back of the net where maybe it's a 50-50 call. I mean, I think everyone's going to hesitate. I mean, the commentator might hesitate a little bit. There won't be as much passion, probably, from the co-commentator. You mean talking about what a glorious goal that was, because now he or she is kind of holding back, thinking, okay, well, maybe there's going to be we're going to VAR now, so we have to wait a minute and a half to find out whether or not that was the goal. And the same thing for the people in the crowds. You mean the fans that would have, in the past, gone absolutely crazy nutso after scoring that glorious goal might now hold back a little bit. So it does change everything.
That happens in in college basketball a lot, I've noticed with 3-point shots, which are automatically reviewed now and slow down the game, which is part of the reason why ESPN, this is not related to soccer, but it is because it sometimes spills into our programming. They have to stop scheduling those in 2-hour windows because of all the stoppages, because of replay. Those games are going 2 hours and 15 minutes now, or 2 hours and 10 minutes, that there's a crowd delayed reaction. Mm-hmm. I've noticed because of that very fact. So sorry to cut you off there, but I think it is absolutely essential. Now that you mentioned that Martin Tyler comment, that probably makes me think a little more about this concept of VAR.
Yeah, I'm okay with VAR personally, but it needs to be speeded up and it needs to be more transparent in terms of what's happening on the pitch. I mean, is a referee going to VAR? Okay, if the referee goes to VAR, then there's some type of, something on screen, or there's something in the stadium, or actually both, that says, okay, we're going to VAR. So we know what's happening, just so there is more transparent. I think the referees probably haven't been doing that so far because they're thinking that they don't want to slow down the game themselves, or they just want to, if it's a quick decision, like a 5-second decision, yeah, that was fine. Keep on playing. That it doesn't upset the flow of the game. But there's a lot of different things that go into this. And I guess one of the other comments we got too from Twitter was somebody saying that the reason that they're getting into soccer and enjoying soccer is because the NFL has become this, where any kind of play happens and there's the video replay and it really sucks out the enjoyment of the game. And that's why they're moving to soccer. And they said that they're not happy with now it kind of moving towards almost the NFL side of things, where it does it can be not as exciting. But I think this is one to watch, Kartik. And I think the Premier League is going to decide, I believe, in the next month or two, whether or not to have VAR for the Premier League starting next season. I still think they've got a lot of work to do before they actually go through with this. And we've seen, too, that if in the Bundesliga and Major League Soccer, it's not perfect. I mean, even in France, too, with the goal decision system there, this past week it wasn't working, so now they've scrapped it and have to go back and review it. It's still a work in progress. And I guess, too, with the World Cup this summer, we'll have to wait and see whether or not the World Cup gets VAR. But
well, there was a theory that they made it so poor. They did such a poor job with it, the Confederations Cup, so they wouldn't have to implement it at the World Cup. So there would be such a backlash. That's a conspiracy theory. But yeah, it was very labored at the Confederations Cup in Germany. I have to say, I haven't liked it. I think it's there have been some really good Bundesliga matches this year that have been I don't want to say damage, that's too strong a word, but have been my enjoyment level has been impacted by long stoppages. And they tend to we talked about this on the previous show when I had interviewed Howard Webb, that they the Bundesliga has taken a very different approach to how they implement it and how they want to get every call right and go back and look at calls, to what Howard Webb, who's now here in the United States, has done with MLS, which is, okay, you either do it instantaneously and figure it out during a natural stoppage, or play resumes, that's it. So MLS, it hasn't been as labored, but I would point out in MLS, there are things that you would think, because there's VAR, would have been corrected and haven't been. Mm-hmm. So then what's the point of it, right? So you have this debate that keep going back and forth on it.
Yeah, and in that Leicester-Fleetwood game, there were 3 decisions through VAR, and because of VAR, it helped all 3 of those decisions be the correct ones, the fair ones. So at the end of the day, that was good, but what do we lose with that? What impact does that have? And the first 2 VAR decisions had no detrimental impact on the game. The third one did. And maybe it's just a matter of just speeding up that process and that would fix things. But this is going to be one we're going to come back to, I think, time and time again. All right, Kartik, let's move on to TV streaming news.
Okay, let's start with some news out of the UK. According to our sources here at World Soccer Talk, they've revealed to us that the MLS TV deal with Sky Sports in England is set to expire at the end of the 2018 Major League Soccer season. So it's not the middle, right? MLS plays on a different calendar. So when we say 2018, we mean the end of December 2018. Sky Sports is currently paying $4.8 million a year for rights to the league. It'll be interesting to see if Sky Sports renews or whether there's a scramble from other TV broadcasters to get the rights away from Sky. I could give you a little bit of background to accompany this story. Prior to 2014, England was covered in an international rights deal that MLS had signed with MP and Silva. That then there was a sub-license, I believe, to Channel 4 or Channel 5 in the UK for that period. Frank Lampard signs in Major League Soccer, or apparently signs, actually signed with Man City, but ended up in Major League Soccer. Steven Gerrard signs with Major League Soccer. And you have David Villa signing with Major League Soccer as they're negotiating the contract. So Sky bites, and they buy they buy into Major League Soccer, and they end up airing games right after the end of Premier League matches or the end of La Liga matches. That first year or two, when those stars were in the league, it went pretty well for them. But now you see an exodus of those players. So it'll be interesting to see if they renew. As I am told, the deal that Eurosport has on the continent, which was negotiated through IMG, who replaced MP and Silva as the media partner, international media partner for Major League Soccer, that runs through 2021 or 2022. I'm trying to get an exact date on that, but that will not be affected. So this is just the Sky deal that's up in 2018.
Yeah, I think I mean definitely the Lampard and Gerrard and some of the other English players that have now retired and left Major League Soccer would have an impact, but I don't think it's going to be a huge impact. I think it's one of those things that with Sky's schedule, it fits in pretty well. It's usually UK time, kind of a 9 o'clock game on a Saturday night, and something to show that's probably not costing Sky Sports much money when you think it's less than $5 million a year for all the games that they get. So, yeah, we'll have to wait and see. But it'll be an interesting one to watch. And my guess is that by the time they do the contract, the actual bidding for this one, we should find out something probably maybe in the summertime. Now, one more thing on the TV streaming news, Kartik, and that's this Saturday in Philadelphia for the United Soccer Coaches Convention. Fox Sports will be there presenting a World Cup 2018 preview. It's going to be Alexi Lalas and Stu Holden being interviewed. It'll be interesting to see what happens here, because Fox, up until this point, hasn't released a lot of details about the World Cup coverage. We know that it's going to be, so far, a very U.S.-centric lineup of commentators: John Strong, Stuart Holden, Alexi Lalas, Fernando Fiore with the studio show, Kate Abdo, studio show, as well as Rob Stone. And the commentators, we can pretty much guess who will be there, but we haven't got a definitive list of those. They haven't announced those. So we'll have to wait and see. And if there's any news that comes out of that event, we'll be sure to share it on next week's show. Now, moving on to TV ratings, Kartik, this past week, we don't have a lot of the numbers because of Martin Luther King Jr. holiday on Monday. There's a delay in the Nielsen reports, but one of the numbers that we do have is from the Copa del Rey match between Barcelona and Celta, and this was the one that aired on Thursday, January 11th, in mid-afternoon. So this one ranked number one among Spanish-language sports cable networks among total viewers. It had 160,000 average, and which is pretty decent for, I think by this point that Barcelona had already wrapped up the moving into the quarterfinals, but still a decent number for a mid-afternoon cup game. Now, Kartik, listener mailbag, we've got a few comments this week from our listeners. The first one is from the Soccer Heretic, and he sent in this tweet. He says, "I have to give rebuttal for the Liga MX's TV ratings. Number one, Liga MX, like Major League Baseball, NFL, and NHL, came up in a different era of mass communications and media coverage. Number two, the vast majority of Liga MX's following is based on cultural connections developed in an era of previous era of the previous statement. Its following in America is also much more heavily weighted in communities with large Mexican heritage populations. Number three, and finally, the quality of play far exceeds Major League Soccer and allows to bring in people who appreciate the quality of play, if not the format of the competition." So definitely some good input and feedback here from the Soccer Heretic, Kartik. What are your thoughts on this one?
Yeah, I think we'll get more into this in our feature topic of the week, but I do think there is a lot Liga MX has going for it. But there's also, to me, a situation where there is a maybe a cultural barrier for some American-based fans of the sport to understand the league. And I think what it is that, well, maybe I'll get into this in the feature topic.
Yeah. I mean, the soccer,
I should say culturally, sorry, Chris, culturally, I don't mean Hispanic versus Anglo. I mean, culturally, in people are either into an American sports mindset or they're into a European football mindset, and Liga MX doesn't really fit either.
I will say, though, Kartik, that the Soccer Heretics point about the history is a good one, because this is something that, I mean, going back to the 1980s, I remember that pretty much the only soccer you could watch would have been on, you mean, Telemundo or, you mean, the Spanish language networks. And oftentimes on a weekend, on a Sunday or a Saturday afternoon, you'd be flipping through and you'd come across a Liga MX game. And that was the only game on at all. I mean, like this nowadays we get, what, 150 to 180 games on a week. In the United States, but usually at that point in the 80s, there'd been like maybe one, if you're lucky, two. So culturally, it has built up a slow and steady following from the 1980s, something that other leagues in the US haven't had the benefit from. I mean, Fox Sports World was what, early 90s, and that was, and then since then, they've been able to kind of build up the Premier League audience. So that's definitely a good point, and I think I agree with the Soccer Heretic in terms of there are things with Liga MX that are to benefit them that others don't have the benefit of. Now, next up is, let me see what we got here. We got Larry Rouse, who sent in this tweet. He says, so one thing I've noticed is with the Premier League goal zone, there are so many commercials and not enough talking, especially towards the end of the show. It's all advertising. Could this be improved upon in any way? There's not enough breakdown of the league during this time for me. Sometimes the 1 hour show feels like 30 minutes and the commercials are 3 to 4 minutes long. Now, this is something, Kartik, that NBC Sports does a good job of in terms of monetizing the Premier League and just trying to make sure that they're generating as much revenue as possible to pay for these rights, which we've mentioned this latest rights cycle is costing them almost $1 billion for 6 years. So, but have you noticed that too in terms of commercials and how much that's impacting the amount of time that of coverage from the Premier League?
Yeah, which is why I think I've been so impressed with the last month. I think there's been more commentary. I singled out the show Liam McHugh and Robbie Musto on Monday after the Borough's not even in the league anymore. After the Stoke is beginning to feel like Borough. Maybe that's why I thought, yeah, Stoke Man United match. We got a lot out of that hour. I think it's because there have been these hour-long goal zones in the past where they've done a lot of highlights. There's been these kind of talk segments where they repeat what they said at halftime or repeat what was said on the broadcast. Then there is a commercial block of 4 minutes. Then there's some sort of something else. And it seems like it's a 20-minute show, right? This time, I felt like I got a good value for the hour. Maybe 45 minutes of actual cognizant analysis. So concise and some points that Musto normally wouldn't get to make. So, I actually tend to agree with his point. I think that the goal zone shows, I kind of cringe when I see they're only a half an hour, because then I'm expecting 10 minutes of analysis. And then they show amended Blazers or whatever after. But this is, I think, an evolving point. And NBC may have had these same internal discussions you're complaining about. And it seems like I've seen some sort of shift in the last month. There was also, I mentioned McHugh and Musto this Monday. A couple weeks ago, there was a Derek Ray, Robbie Earle goal zone, which was similar. It was an hour long, just the two of them, and there was a lot on that show that you could unpackage and take from it. So I think it's a valid point, but I would retort and say I think NBC is aware of your critique, and they're working on fixing it, it appears.
Yeah, I don't feel like I'm missing out, though, Kartik, because when I do watch the Premier League on NBC Sports, in terms of the timing of the commercials, I don't feel it's disruptive. It's oftentimes, I mean, they're not doing it right in the middle of You'll Never Walk Alone, I mean, from Anfield. They're letting that play out, and as soon as that's over, they go to a quick commercial, come back, and get ready, come back for the start of the game. So they've gotten into a good rhythm where it's, I mean, the commercial comes on, and then I might, I mean, jump on Twitter or something. And to me, I expect it. Goalzone, I don't watch as much as some people probably do, so I don't notice that as much. But there's always, I mean, to me, I would normally go online and watch the highlights if I want to do it, if I really want to see the highlights. But it's still a good point by Larry. Last but not least, Kartik, Raymond Orozco messaged us through Facebook, and he said, I listen to a lot of soccer podcasts, and people have interviewed potential U.S. soccer president candidates, and I like what some of them have to say and a range of topics, but I think they are delusional when they talk about the economics and money of soccer. I read two books recently that I think all U.S. soccer fans should read, and one's Money in Soccer, and the other one is Soccernomics by Stefan Zomanski. And the question I would love to ask all of the candidates is, do you think that sports teams have to be economically profitable to be viable? That's a great question, Kartik, because that's one we didn't ask Kyle. I mean, if you ask somebody in the UK, that answer might be quite different than somebody in the US, especially if it's a business person.
Right. I think the thing about Kyle now, since we had our conversation with him, he has released a plan which is incredibly detailed. You could even say that it's too detailed for a candidate. Maybe he's exposing himself to getting a lot of holes poked in it. But I really like his thought process about how you make some of these changes on a realistic timeline. So I think he himself is weighing, is this a public good? Is this a community oriented or nationalistic thing? Or is it a for-profit business? I think even he's trying to balance that. We don't know, right? The American mindset is it's a for-profit business. They're franchises, they're businesses. The mentality in England is different. The mentality in Germany, which we led off the show with, is 180 degrees from where it is in the United States, right? And I think Martino, from reading his plan through, which I encourage everybody to look at, it's everyone's game, progress plan, a way forward that he released on Monday. You get the sense that he's trying to, those are competing ideologies that he's trying to balance. And it's tough. So I don't know the answer, but it's a great idea to ask all the candidates those questions, and hopefully we will get the chance to do that in the next 3.5 weeks before the election.
Yeah, you look at Detroit as one example, Kartik, and you look at Detroit City FC, and I mean to me that's a very much a community club that's grassroots, that has good morals and is trying to build something in the community to benefit the people that live in that area, and give them something back versus. I mean, the Major League Soccer team that could move into Detroit in the coming months if they get the expansion there. And the difference between that club, if it happens, which is purely for profits, purely for generating as much money as possible.
And the fact that Major League Soccer and the proprietors of that potential Detroit club, Chris, seem to have no interest in engaging those people who built Detroit City FC. That, to me, is more galling than everything, because they have built something very special, very unique on the American sporting landscape, not just on the soccer landscape, on the sporting landscape. And you've got essentially corporatists trying to take them down. It doesn't sit well with a lot of people. Detroit is a real sore subject. We try and remain objective about these things. But yeah, I'm glad you brought Detroit up, Chris, because I think that is where you see the contrast in black and white in this country.
Yeah, and that's one of the things too, Kartik. It's not just Major League Soccer. I mean, the Premier League is all about profits at this point. But it is, I mean, you have lower league clubs that are more about the communities, trying to, again, provide it something of value to the community. And it is a question. I mean, it goes back to, say, musicians. I mean, do you want to be kind of your local musician who's enjoying it and, you mean, playing every weekend? Or do you want to go and you mean, sell a million records and sell out and become a worldwide star? I mean, it's there's so many different levels to look at it. And for soccer, I mean, this is a great question from our listener, from Raymond, is that what do these candidates think? I mean, how do they balance the two? Because there is the profit side and there's the non-profit side. Yeah, it's a lot of big questions, a lot of big topics this week, Kartik, in this week's podcast. So listeners, if you do have any feedback, questions, or anything you want to ask us, go ahead and send us an email to web@worldsoccertalk.com. You can tweet us at our new Twitter handle, which is @WorldSoccerTalk, or send us a message through Facebook. That's facebook.com/WorldSoccerTalk. We'd love to read those out on air and to share those with the other listeners. Okay, Kartik, let's move on to our featured topic of the week. And this week we have a special guest. We have Walter Franco, who's Liga MX's viewer and expert. And Walter, give us a little bit of background in regards to the company you work for and just you mean, where you're from and also how much Liga MX do you watch every week?
Well, first of all, thank you, Kartik and Christopher, for inviting me to be on the show. So I work for a boutique sports consulting firm called Vix Advisors. We're based out of Utah. I've been with the firm for about 3 years, and the core business of the firm is involving sponsorship analysis, economic impact, and feasibility studies for sports facility development. Since I came on, I've really been building the soccer business side for the firm, and that deals with brokering friendlies between Liga MX and MLS clubs, sponsorship, and other business development opportunities for Liga MX clubs, including the Mexican Federation in the United States. And so I'm originally from the San Diego-Tijuana area, so I really understand those border relations between the U.S. and Mexico culturally, growing up in a bilingual home. And so I grew up watching Liga MX my whole life. And so, I'm very in tune with everything that's happening from, you know, business side and from the historical sense with what's happened throughout the years recently with its growth commercially in the U.S. as well. So I feel like I've been able to get a good pulse on what's been happening with Liga MX, and very exciting times, of course, with this Landon Donovan signing. But only if the league and the club, in this case Club Leon, really capitalize on this marketing moment, which in my opinion they haven't.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's actually perfect timing to have you on the show, Walter. We appreciate your time. So with the Landon Donovan move, I mean, do you think it is more of a seeing talent, wanting to bring him in and see if he can make a difference with the team? Or is it more about the marketing? But like you just said, that from the marketing point of view, they haven't really capitalized on it so far. So is it more about bringing this player in and seeing if he can help help the team in the league?
You know, in my opinion, I really do think it's more of a marketing tool. I mean, obviously he does have his strengths. He's in terms of leadership, his experience both domestically and abroad. And, many people have even mentioned the point of him being in León in Mexico and almost mending wounds with, you know, what's happened recently politically between relations between Mexico and the U.S. And, you know, if you watched the announcement a few days ago, you know, the stadium had in each seat, they had a Mexican flag and a U.S. flag, and there were fans chanting USA, USA. So at that, at the very least, Club León has succeeded in that aspect, and there's definitely a lot more interest there. I don't know how much he's going to contribute. As you probably know, he hasn't played in a few years. And even when he played for the LA Galaxy when he came back out of retirement, he was very limited in his participation. And so, you know, he's going to be taking someone's spot, assuming if he starts, which I don't think he will. He might be coming in the last few minutes of a match. But, at the end of the day, I think it really is more of a marketing tactic more than anything else, similarly to what happened with Ronaldinho and Querétaro. Mm-hmm. And so time will tell. But I'm definitely going to watch. It's just going to be very interesting on so many levels. And I know that a lot of Mexican fans will watch. And more importantly, your mainstream American soccer fan is going to watch as well.
Yeah, we just did a poll, I think it was on yesterday, on Twitter, to ask people if they'd be more likely to watch Liga MX, less likely, or about the same. And 22% of our followers said that they'd be more likely to watch Liga MX because of Landon Donovan playing for Club Lyon. Do you think it's going to have, I mean, long-term, could that have an impact on TV ratings in the US? I mean, Liga MX TV ratings are already very strong, but do you think it could take it to the next level or encourage maybe more American players to go south of the border to play in Mexico?
I mean, it depends. I mean, having someone with Landon Donovan's historical significance, that's not going to happen very often, obviously, unless maybe you have Michael Bradley come play in Liga MX or Jozy Altidor, something like that. But I think in the short term, it will generate interest. The only issue is with TV, Univision Deportes right now has the rights for basically every Liga MX club in the U.S. And they, as you know, they have a partnership with Facebook Live to show select matches in the U.S. in English. And so the question is, okay, are they going to capitalize on this and show more Leon matches on Facebook Live so that English speaking fans can watch? And, you know, since Leon's only going to be there for a year, I'm sure we'll see kind of an uptick in interest. But once he leaves, I don't know if that interest is going to stay. I don't know if people are going to stick around to watch. So I think it's more of an interest in, okay, how is he going to do it in Mexico? Is he going to, you know, do very well? Or is he going to show that he's completely out of shape? And I think for a lot of American soccer fans that only get a chance to really watch Liga MX clubs during the CONCACAF Champions League, this is going to be another test for them to say, okay, well, how good can an American player do in Liga MX, and to really almost set a barometer for the quality of Liga MX clubs to an MLS club. So Leon has won championships in the past, over the last 5 years, maybe I think once. And, you know, right now they're kind of mid-tier in the table. So it'll be interesting to see how well they do. And I think, and you followed the ratings more than anyone else, Christopher, you as well, Kardik. So I think it'll be very interesting to see that uptick specifically for Leon matches, especially if they're in English. But overall, in terms of Liga MX, I don't know if it's going to see a major increase for other clubs that would be playing on Univision.
Walter, if you don't mind for a minute, walk our listeners who tend to be the listeners who tend to only follow European football through some of the nuances of Liga MX and how it's structured, the tournaments are structured, and from a business standpoint as well.
Sure. So from the league structure, you have a fall season and a spring season. So each season consists of 17 matches. Usually for the fall season, you're starting in late July and ending in late November, with the playoffs starting in early December. Then you kick up again in mid to late January with for the spring season, ending in late May, which includes the playoffs. And so it's really year round. It's kind of, in my opinion, I really think that Liga MX needs to convert to a European model calendar, running through August through May, where it just makes it more interesting, because you have two championships in one calendar year. And so it almost dilutes a little bit that value of having a championship season. But at the same time, from a fan's perspective, you know, if the fall season goes bad, you can always say, oh, well, there's next season, which is just, you know, 3 weeks away. And then the same thing moving into the fall season. The other thing, too, to keep in mind with from a league standpoint is relegation. It's very complicated based on points, and it's it's cumulative over various seasons. And so and then we can go into some controversies that have happened with certain clubs not being relegated or being bought out and rebranded as the same team that was relegated so they can stay in the first division. But I think that's a topic for another day. From a business standpoint, one of the challenges that Liga MX has is that they're not very visible outside of Mexico and the US. And a lot of that has to do with the way that the league is set up. It's very much the Wild West out there. They haven't really caught up with the times with what pro sports leagues in the U.S. have done in terms of bundling their TV rights. So both domestically in Mexico and also in the U.S. and beyond, every club can negotiate their own TV rights. So that might be good for a club, say Chivas or America, which can maximize their value. But for other clubs like León and also Querétaro and Veracruz, who don't have much of an appeal outside of Mexico, it's hard for them to get a good deal. And so one of the things that I've talked with both with the league and also just anecdotally and other observations with other interviews, et cetera, is that the league really needs to try to find a way to bundle their TV rights outside of Mexico at the very least, so that they can really sell the league internationally, which is one of their main strategies if they really want to globalize the league. But that's really the biggest stumbling block, because TV revenues would be one of the greatest revenue drivers for the league and to help expand their growth. So it's an exciting league. There's a lot of young talent. It's kind of at a crossroads now, because it exports a lot of players, mostly Mexican players, to Europe, but it also has recently been importing players from Europe. So, for example, André Pierre Gignac, and now with Menez coming to play with Club America, Ronaldinho in the past, Landon Donovan. And so it's definitely an exciting league. They've had a lot of success, on the Western Hemisphere. But I think there's definitely a lot more room for growth.
Last question for me, Walter, is in regards to Liga MX and well, more so Club Lyon. How capable is Club Lyon of launching a really good marketing program in the United States to sell Landon Donovan shirts and to market this club outside of just television? But and if they're not capable, I mean, is there an opportunity, whether it's for your company or other companies, to really do a better job of trying to market these clubs in the United States to bring them up to a higher level of visibility?
Mm-hmm. Well, to be completely honest, I think they missed the boat with this launch for Landon Donovan, and I don't know if they're ever going to catch up. So some issues that came about with this signing is at minimum, they could have had a joint release that was both in English and in Spanish. They could have launched a social media channel or Twitter or Facebook accounts in English to kind of start talking to casual American soccer fans or U.S. soccer fans that would only follow Landon Donovan specifically. They didn't do that. The website is still under construction, believe it or not, which is very difficult because people probably want to know what León is about. Mm-hmm. They could have given kind of a brief history about León in English to kind of let people understand what León is about, their history, their significance in Mexican soccer. They didn't do that. They have their kit sponsor, Pirma, which is a Mexican company, has very, very limited distribution in the United States. And so it looks like it's going to be very difficult to find a Landon Donovan jersey, short of, buying a generic León jersey and then taking it to a local soccer shop and trying to have, them screen print Donovan's name and number on the back of the jersey. And so it doesn't appear that there's a plan in place, which is a shame. With these specific negotiations, this has been happening for quite a while now. So they could have had a marketing plan in place, but it looks like they're just kind of winging it, to be honest. And it's kind of the same thing with Querétaro too. Querétaro really didn't capitalize on having Ronaldinho there, regardless of how much he actually wanted to be there or not. They really didn't make the most of that. So what you're going to see happening with León is, I think there's going to be definitely a lot more interest for MLS clubs to play León for friendly matches this summer. And so I think you might see that, and there'd be a lot of interest from MLS clubs to host them and a lot of interest from fans. But, I don't really see León engaging with any marketing agencies, any research firms in the U.S. And a lot of that has to do with, first of all, the money that's involved to them. If they don't see the money up front or the return on the investment within, a week or so, they're really not going to put any money into anything that they don't have the patience, so to speak, to be able to wait for that ROI. Right. Yeah. And so I don't expect much to change, to be honest, which is unfortunate. which is very unfortunate.
Yeah, it's a shame, really, because I mean, we know, all of us, all three of us know, but also the listeners know, that the U.S. market is ripe for the picking. And I mean, there's a lot of communities, sure, with not a lot of soccer clubs in the area, but you mean, you bring some of these Mexican teams to play friendlies or to establish clubs or youth clubs. There's huge opportunities in the U.S. It's such a big country, and still there's opportunities there. But, well, Walter, thank you so much for being on the show. We really appreciate it. If listeners want to follow you or stay tuned to kind of your thoughts on Liga MX, where's the best place they can find you?
I'm on Twitter at VW Franco. To be honest, I'm not much of a follow at all. I'm usually typically boring, but from time to time, I'll share some tidbits here and there. So any follow is appreciated. But you guys are great to follow, so I definitely... I haven't engaged much with you on Twitter before, but I definitely listen to your podcast and listen to your analysis on the happenings of soccer in the USA and also with TV ratings. So a lot of the info that I get is actually from you guys. So you guys have been a great resource for me. So I appreciate your hard work.
Awesome. Cool. Well, Walter, thank you so much for being on the show. Walter. And we'll chat soon.
Sounds good. Thanks to you both. Take care.
All right. Cheers.
Thank you, Walter.
All right, Kartik, so let's, before we move on to, I do want to mention, actually, on our website, worldsoccertalk.com, we published a viewing guide to Liga MX this week that goes into a lot more detail, that talks about where you can watch matches on television, as well as streaming, as well as links to watch coverage of Liga MX in English language, and how the league is structured, and Copa MX and all the different tournaments, etc., Supercopa. So if you do want to get that, it's for free. It's a free download. Just go to worldsoccertalk.com and there'll be a link under the navigation that says free guides, and there's one for Liga MX right there. Now, Kartik, where can listeners find you on the internet if they want to kind of keep up on top of what you're doing these days?
Check me out at on Twitter at KKFLA737.
All right, Kartik. Well, thank you for listening. You can get a new episode of the World Soccer Talk podcast every Thursday. Every episode is released on SoundCloud, YouTube, Stitcher, iTunes, TuneIn, Audioboom, and worldsoccertalk.com. If you like the show, share it with your friends on social media and give us a review on iTunes. We'd greatly appreciate it. And Kartik, what should they do?
Enjoy your football.